Today's program has been brought to you by Cane Vineyard and Winery, a Napa Valley winery committed to respecting the soil and dedicated to the creation of three Cabernet blends. For more information, visit cane5.com.
I'm Laura Stanley, host of Inside School Food. You are listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more. Hey everybody, and welcome to the Farm Report, where we talk about the nitty-gritty of agriculture and food production each week. I'm your host, Holly Cederholm, and I'm on the ground at Organic Seed Alliance's 8th Organic Seed Growers Conference in Corvallis, Oregon. On February 5th, Friday, following a full day of workshops on all things organic seed, I caught up with Lane Selman of the Culinary Breeding Network and Chef Timothy Wastel of Sweetie D in North Portland. What follows is a conversation about a unique collaboration between plant breeders and chefs, enabled by the Culinary Breeding Network. Just a note on the low din in the background, that's a swarm of conference goers tasting variety trials and offering their feedback.
I'm Lane Selman, and I'm a researcher at Oregon State University, and for about 10 years I've been doing a lot of different projects with organic farmers. Diversified organic farmers at fresh market direct sales, so CSAs, farmers markets, selling directly to restaurants and some wholesale. And I've worked on a lot of different projects. They could be about insect and disease problems that they're having, and they could be about nutrient issues. But oftentimes, in the past 10 years, it has been about variety selection. Even if you're talking about like problems with disease, it's like late blight in potatoes, we go back to like, well, really, what varieties are you growing? Because you could find a variety just genetically that is resistant to that. And so we talk a lot about that. And so in a lot of these projects, we just kept kind of going back to that quite a bit. And then with these farmers, everything that they're concerned about, no matter what they're growing, flavor is a really big deal for them because it is organic and because it is fresh market and because it is direct sales to consumers. All those three things together means like that's the expectation that it's going to taste really good,
yeah,
right?
It could be the best disease resistant cucumber on the market, but if it tastes like water, no one's going to buy it.
Yeah, we saw that quite a bit, and I mean, it seems like really common sense, but we were working on potatoes, and then we said, well, you know, let's bring some breeders in and let's talk to them, because I know that there's got to be something that's resistant to late blight. Is a really big problem still with potatoes, and the potato breeders, it's not on their radar to think about flavor, because they're mostly breeding for French fries and they're breeding for other markets.
And when you have French fries, they're covered in fat and salt. And
exactly.
They taste good. Yeah.
Right. So it's just not a priority for them. For us, it's a priority. So in a lot of these projects, we started doing a lot of variety trials to see which varieties performed really well on organic farms, because that's what this entire conference is about, is that organic farmers have very different needs than conventional farmers, and so that we need seed that is bred in those systems. And so we're growing these things out on different farms. We're seeing which ones perform the best. And then we got to the part where it was like, well, you know, we're not really evaluating in any kind of formal way for flavor. For texture, for other culinary attributes. So that's kind of when the Culinary Breeding Network kind of came about. And it was when we were looking at some roasting peppers, and I knew that I was evaluating them on the field, and I saw some that Frank Morton had actually bred, and they grew really amazing compared to all the other varieties that we were looking at. So I didn't want to be the person that was deciding whether they tasted great or not, because also, who am I? I'm an agriculture researcher. So I knew a lot of chefs, including Tim here, who's been Tim Wastel in Portland, Oregon, who is a chef and has been involved since day one. And I asked all these chefs if they wanted to get together and taste these. And so they tasted raw, roasted, and sautéed, much like you're seeing today, so in different applications, and then they got to see it, the fruit whole and then halved of these peppers. They tasted all of them, we knew which ones they liked the best, and then the conversation just kept going, because normally in sensory evaluations, you would go into like a little white room, taste these things, and walk away, and there wouldn't be this conversation afterward.
Yeah.
And so then there was this amazing conversation afterward where we did have farmers, and we had a couple of breeders, and we had all these chefs in the room, and the chefs started telling us about these things that they wanted that were not on the radar of the breeder, because the breeder is a breeder. They don't work in a commercial kitchen. They're not that intimate with it, and they just hadn't really had access to that, those stakeholders yet.
The thing that's been just out there in the open has been the open line of communication from the mm-hmm. very beginning, getting everyone involved in that conversation.
Yeah,
it's hugely helpful. I mean, it's great for us because, you know, we as chefs have an opportunity to continue to focus on supporting small farms while being part of the conversation on how can we make this produce more delicious or different in ways that we'd like it.
So, Tim, where are you a chef based out of?
Portland, Oregon.
And where do you work?
I work at a restaurant called Sweet Edie in North Portland.
And is it focused, would you consider it like a farm-to-table, or were you just like interested in flavor? Like what was the selling point for you to get more involved in this kind of work?
So I moved to Portland during what I guess could be referred to as like the bacon boom. I moved here
There's
in...
a bacon boom.
Yeah, it was nuts. It was just pork. Pork on like every... Pork on like whole animal on, you know, what's the weirdest part of... you know, this thing that we can use, this animal that we can use on anything else. I moved here from Colorado for produce. So I moved here to be closer to awesome farms with a longer growing season and just people that have, you know, there's this infrastructure here that's just fantastic. There's people that have been at it for 25 and 30 years and training, you know, younger generations to just continue to grow awesome produce. And yeah, I've just bounced around the Portland area at a number of, you could call them farm-to-table restaurants. I think that term is in any good food city or in any good food area, it's kind of a no-brainer at this point. I mean, I think it's...
because that's the norm.
Exactly, like, yeah. And that's awesome. That's huge. It was not like that when I started cooking. Yeah, just really vegetable-focused, flavor-focused restaurants with a huge, you know, eye on sustainability and on, you know... getting truly local food and getting, you know, buying things at the right time and adapting to both what people have on their lists, but having a conversation with the folks that are growing the food and even now the people that are producing the seed as far as, you know, how can we get better? What can we do to keep moving it forward and get stronger?
Yeah, that was one thing that was really incredible is, you know, I really just thought, okay, I have these finished varieties. I want to know which ones taste the best. I'm going to bring all these chefs in the room. They're going to tell me, and then I'm going to know. And then I'm like, that's the end of the conversation. And I barely even told them, like, what any kind of background about these peppers. And then I knew which varieties they liked the best, but then they started pointing out these traits that they really liked. And then they started asking these questions that made me think, oh my God, they really want to know a lot more. Like, they're ready to understand. Like, I always say that, like, they know their farmer, but behind their farmer is this door that nobody walks through. And that's, like, the seed, and that's the breeding, and that's what people don't really know about. And so all of a sudden, they're asking all these really, you know, these questions, letting me know that they're really interested in it.
And
so
the door opened.
Right. And then we, like, the next year, we repeated it, and that year is when we really started telling them. We started really telling them all about plant breeding and organic plant breeding and, like, the farmers that they already knew, because we are very lucky in Portland where we have a really nice, tight-knit group of chefs that are very, you know, it, like you said, like, they're
like
it's just, like, the norm, and that's what they're going to do. They know that you buy things that are local and fresh, that they're going to taste better. And they're so, you know, flexible as far as, like, it's like, this is what we have available. I mean, that was one thing that was kind of difficult because it was like, they're like, well, whatever. I'm like, no, what do you want? They're like, whatever you have available. I'm like, no, now we're asking you
to help
what
us
you want. Because you now have the breeders in the room and the chefs, and they can talk together, because the breeders oftentimes do not know what the chefs want. The chefs know what they want, and now all of a sudden they're part of this conversation.
So what was an example, we'll continue with the pepper example, what was an example of one of the traits that the chefs were like, hey, this is something that would be really great, or you could use a different crop?
Sure. Things like peppers with thick walls and square shoulders. The thick walls hold up really well to things like roasting or pickling and just kind of have more body.
And as far as the skin doesn't like peel off and get stuck in your teeth.
Yeah. Yeah. That's not what you want. And then, the squared off shoulders, that's more of a, more of an economic thing, just as far as yield goes. You know, it's much easier to process a pepper, cutting it in half, and, you know, scraping out the seeds and everything, and not having to dig around the stem. So if it's squared and shouldered up, you can just cut it, pop the stem off of it, and it saves time for, you know, whoever's prepping the produce, and it saves you money because there's, you know, less going into the compost or, you know, the stock pot or wherever you put your pepper seeds and stems.
Yeah. So I'd like to talk a little bit about what's going on here. Mm-hmm. So we're at the Organic Seed Growers Conference in Corvallis, and this is the first day. We've all spent like a whole day going to these great seed workshops on breeding and seed economics and education. And now there's a bunch of people huddled around this beautiful display, a cabbage and radicchio. And what is the other? What we've got? So walk me through what we've got going on out there.
Sure. In the room further away, we've got a squash tasting. And while you guys were hanging out on farms and going to conferences and things, I was roasting squash and washing chicories and cutting vegetables in little pieces for the tasting. In that room, we've got a tasting of 8 squashes. So 4 kabocha types and 4 delicata types, F1s and open pollinated seed varieties, both raw and roasted. And then we've got ballots to just kind of garner feedback from the folks that are tasting that.
Yeah.
As far as things that they like, things that they don't like, would they purchase it? Would they use it in their restaurant? Would they grow it?
And that information that we get back when we do tastings like this for preferences, we match it up with field information. So we know, we've trialed all these on our farms, and we know which ones perform well. So then we can advise farmers. We don't want to advise farmers, like, grow this variety. It performs really well in the field when it tastes terrible. Yeah. And then we don't want to tell them about one that tastes really fantastic but doesn't perform well in the field. So then we get this, like, really fantastic, you know.
Synergistic kind of mix.
Right. And that is oftentimes, like, not information that has been available.
Yeah. So I have kind of raided the table out there, and I'm looking at these little paper plates that I've labeled according to the code that you have. So this is like, you don't have the varieties listed on the tables during the tasting. So they're sort of shorthand for based on the species information. So we've got...
Do you want me to explain chicory?
Yeah.
So we also have a chicory and a cabbage tasting out there. And so one really big focus for us in the projects that we're working on, in Oregon State University and Organic Seed Alliance, we're working on a project together to look at crops that do well in the wintertime. We want things that can perform well. We call it overwintering, so that we can leave them out in the field without plastic, and they're going to withstand the winter time. So we're really looking at this, you know, entire food system for local food. Because we're totally fine in August and September, and we got everything in the world, but we need things to eat in the winter time. And so these are chicories and cabbages that have performed really well in the field, and they're out there still right now.
And
so
they also, from like an agricultural standpoint, they need to go through the winter to produce seed. So they mm-hmm. have to be able to withstand that in order to produce seed in this environment.
Yes. Okay. And then also, so for the chicories, we have Castle Franco types, which kind of look like a lettuce, a green with a speckly streaks of red. So it's a more mild, a more sweeter chicory. And then we have what we're calling Bocciolo di Rosa. Is that how you pronounce it? Bocciolo di Rosa. And that actually means rosebud. And I apologize for my terrible Italian,
even though
I am Italian.
It's beautiful.
For the record, Lane Sicilian, and that's how she pronounces that.
Sicilian American. And so, and these are ones that have performed really well in the field. We're tasting them side by side, raw, to see what people think. And then also, Tim has made a really magnificent salad that he can tell you about.
Yeah, certainly. So it was just a really simple kind of 5-ingredient thing. The bitter greens, some really thinly sliced raw black futsu squash, dressed with a citronette, including anchovies, lemon juice, and some pecorino with lots of cracked black pepper. Give the people a little bit of variety and see how a couple of sort of oddball greens can be thrown together with something that is even more oddball to most of the people out there, which is eating squash raw. And tastes pretty delicious.
But it seems like a really simple preparation too. So it's like something.
There was nothing to it. Yeah. I mean, it's the hardest part is not cutting yourself on the mandolin to
to get the squash, then. So now then like the sheet, so you have this, setup where people can like scoop out a little sample and blind taste them sort of side by side. It's not, it's blind in that they don't know what the variety is, exactly. But they're actually seeing, they're seeing the chopped up bowls, but they're also seeing the whole heads of radicchio, exactly. So that they can kind of be like, as farmers, they want to know like, hey, like, what does this look like? They're not maybe so much into like what it looks like in the salad bowl. Well, more might be, but,
right.
But then you have these sheets that are kind of blank with comments, and then sort of you're asking them to kind of rate and give feedback on it. So I don't know. I thought maybe we could do a little bit of the, so I prepared these little plates. So do you want to, should we go through one of these and maybe,
certainly.
Yeah. So,
maybe start with the Castle Francos.
Yeah, let's do it. Okay, so I've kind of broken it up into, I don't think I got everything that was out there, but I think I got big enough pieces that we can like rip them up, and maybe we don't have to do the whole plate, but I thought it'd be fun to, for you experts to tell me. I can give my feedback too, but. So you're right, it's kind of, it's lettuce-y in texture. It's more like a romaine or something that's like a little bit waxier, but it's not super. It's got crunchy, but it's not like cabbage texture where it's like you're really putting some chew into it. But
it's a nice alternative for lettuce in the wintertime. You know, it really is something that when you can't have lettuce, you can't have something like that out in the field during the winter. You can, but you, and you taste that little bitterness, that sharpness, right? I mean, that's something. I feel like that's something that potentially is something that people will enjoy more in the future. As far as definitely as we're working with chefs. They really embrace and are excited to have more bitterness in our diets.
Yeah, and bitter, it's like one of those flavors that really like rounds out, especially it seems like I haven't tasted it yet, but you describing the salad seems like you're really trying to work like these other, we've got like the squash, which might be a little bit sweeter, and like the other ingredients that kind of play off one another.
Yeah, bitter is super important. And I mean, as far as this, the leaf that we just tasted, that's I would call it like a gateway chicory or chicory 101 if there ever was one, because it's so mild.
It is really mild.
And just the fact that we can have these beautiful, these gorgeous leafy greens in February is more exciting to me than Oregon white truffles or Wagyu beef or any of the prized, you know, expensive sort of sought after ingredients that are all over menus right now. It's just gorgeous.
Okay, can we try it? We'll just work our way through this plate here and see. This already feels like it's a little bit, it feels thicker when I'm ripping it apart.
That one, my piece at least, was more bitter.
Yeah.
Much crunchier and much more bitterness, yeah.
Yeah.
Thicker. Leaf.
Darker color, too. That one, the must have been either an outer leaf or... just thought the entire thing was a little bit darker across the board.
That it almost has like the oxalic, and it might be because I got a stemmier piece, but it has like the oxalic acid kind of flavor that you get from like a Swiss chard and a spinach, where the other one didn't. Of course, we're not getting, like you said, that we might be eating an outer leaf versus an inner leaf, so it's not like a true side by side, but yeah.
It's fine. I mean, you can taste the difference. It's right there, and if they were in the same salad bowl, I mean, it would look like it came from the same plant.
Yeah, yeah. And then we've got this final one, which is a tiny piece. I didn't really prepare us for it, but... And again, this already seems thinner.
That one's actually a little sweet and kind of tangy.
Very sweet. Very, very sweet.
And so now... Okay, so let's pretend that we were to submit these comments on... We've just gone through the tasting, and we've determined, you know, some textural things, some taste things. What's, like, the next step? Like, you're going to go back and collate these comments? Like, what happens when, after everyone folds up these sheets and walks away?
Right. Well, we like to go through and we tally them up. This is a really large tasting, so a lot of times we don't, statistically analyze these or anything. This is kind of more about engagement and having people really kind of be exposed to some of these foods, some of these crops that they might want to grow, and also... and then also, like, taste side by side different varieties. Because often, actually, some of these Castle Francos started from the same seed source, and there's been doing breeding and selecting, and it's come out of the, you know, from the original population. So as people's, actually, their parents are
probably in the field right now.
Yeah, they are, like, their values and their preferences of the breeder are actually reflected in these, because a lot of them have started from this one variety that comes from Italy, and they've just done their selections, and you can look at them in the field and you can taste them and taste differences just based on the individuals that have decided what they're going to save or not. So that's pretty exciting. So with this kind of thing, we're just trying to get like a really quick glimpse at, like, because a lot of times we'll go back and then all of it, you know, we'll have, say, like, we have 200 of these ballots and we have 150 of them best flavor, the same one. We want to know that.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, we've already chosen these based on how well they performed in the field, but then, you know, we really want to know what people's, it's a really broad section of, I mean, this is the Organic Seed Growers Conference, so it's people that come to that, but it is a lot more people than we normally have, where we have like a very focused, yeah, you know, like with all of our chefs, maybe we have 25 or 30 people at tasting, but there's 500 people here tonight.
Yeah.
And so that is a lot of people to tell us, and if we have an overwhelming response about best texture, best flavor, or best appearance, then we really want to know that.
Yeah, if it turns out that, you know, CF3 is mm-hmm. the winner by 75%, then we should do something with that information.
Yeah.
Do you have any clear predictions based on this sampling that you did? I mean, I think they all tasted pretty good.
I think that people have different preferences too. I mean, I do feel like some people are not really into bitter yet, I feel like. And I know that I've gone to a restaurant in Portland that uses somebody's, I'm not going to name any names with all these, but they do use a local chicory grower, and he has done a lot of selections on his own farm, and he's gone so far in the way of selecting against bitterness that to me it's not bitter enough.
Yep.
So actually when I tasted these three, CF1 was sort of like, was the bitter, there's bitterness, and it was a level I liked. The CF2 was a little too much, and then CF3 did not have enough.
Yep.
So that's my preference, but there's a lot of different people, and that's why we like to have all this information, because then we can like create multiple varieties for, you know, because there's a lot of different preferences out there.
Yeah, and that helps with just tailoring, and it keeps, even though mm-hmm. you're not trying to tunnel in the genetic diversity, you're just trying to have better mm-hmm. Information about how to describe the attributes and market it to different wants and needs based on you might want a thicker leaf
right.
for a totally. Certain preparation totally. And a thinner leaf for another and that kind of thing.
We do a lot of that kind of work too, not just with preferences, but with descriptives, and Tim is really involved in that. So like with the squash right now, we do a lot of work where he's tasting squash and not really talking about his preferences, but
there was just
describing
zero.
The different attributes that it has.
Yeah. Trying to figure out just exactly what these different squashes taste like. And it could be, you know, there were days where I would taste four different kombucha types, and it'd be easy to say, it's a kombucha squash. They all taste the same. Not true at all. Drastically, drastically different. Just kind of going down the road of trying to better understand them and trying to be able to better describe them and you know exactly when they're ripe and when they're not, so that we can sort of have that platform to use to teach other folks to understand these.
When you're doing these taste trials, do you think it matters much with squash particularly? I was thinking in terms of ripeness. So are you doing them all grown like the CF3, for example, are all of those, when you're doing a tasting of that, are they coming from the same grower in the same field? So it is. So it could be like the growth, like I was talking. I don't know how much. I mean, it does matter because you have different nutrients in mm-hmm. your fields. Like I was recently talking to a chef down in South Carolina who's working with two very different heritage breed pigs, but they're coming from the same farmer and have the same diet. So even though they have different fat profiles, they really taste very similar, based on the feed versus. So it seems like that might be part of it too, is if like the squash, for instance, if they're all, you know, coming from, someone cured them the same way or the same length of time, they might have a different flavor than if they were cured more optimally or less optimally.
We're minimizing all those variables so that we're looking really at variety, because flavor is genetics times environment always. And so particularly like with cabbage, and if you stress it, if you stress cabbage, then it throws out more glycosinolates. And so that is what makes cabbage taste mustardy and strong.
Yeah.
And so if it's stressed, and you can stress it if you like that. I like that flavor, so you can stress it and you can make that. So we try to minimize all that noise so that we're actually only looking at variety
like
by variety, and that's
of
it.
The variety.
Yes.
And that's I guess more toward the preferential tastings though. Mm-hmm. Right? Because the squash, the sensory analysis sort of descriptive ones. We've done two rounds. We did the first round at the tail end of 2015. That was in November, right? Mm-hmm. And then just finished up the next round a couple of weeks ago. And those, like all of the bricks and the dry matter was taken at OSU, and Alex Stone.
That's Oregon State University.
Yes, yeah. Alex Stone, who sort of is spearheading the squash side of that, has got pretty meticulous notes on how they came about. I mean, whether they were dry farmed or irrigated, mm-hmm, how many days mm-hmm. they spent on the vine, how long they were cured for, mm-hmm. like what environs they were cured under.
She even marked, they tagged them pollination dates so they know exactly how old they are. So, yeah, so, you know, you can, this is like science researchers, so they're pretty, they can get pretty anal about, like, yeah. we're really trying to make sure that we're just looking at variety differences. So trying to minimize all variables.
Yeah.
Because they can, you know, dry farming, squash, potatoes, a lot of things can make things taste very different.
Because it alters the, it plays with the sugar, starch, how, like why does it
It can concentrate it flavors a lot more.
Yeah.
Particularly, there's a huge, you know, not a huge demand, but there's a lot of demand for people that are, like, know about that. They would prefer, like, the a lot of them prefer,
yeah.
you know, tomatoes. Tomatoes, a lot of times it makes the skin thicker sometimes, but it does concentrate flavors because they don't have as much moisture content.
Perhaps not the best, I'm going to pick this tomato up and eat it kind of a thing, but for a sauce tomato or something that you're going to process.
Mm-hmm. It makes a difference.
Delicious, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it sounds like you've got, like, the best of the food geeks. You've got, like, the scientist, researcher geeks, and the chef geeks, and they're coming together.
It's really fantastic. I mean, it seems like it's taken a long time, but, you know, it's really exciting. I think that both sides are just completely excited and flustered to be in the room together, you know? Yeah, it's, like, getting so much out of it. It's, like, such a symbiotic relationship, I feel like.
So what, like, the end, so you've done the tastings, you've got the chef's input, you've got the researcher's input, and then where does the farmer come in? Are you, where these varieties you've once you've done this extensive trialing and got all this great feedback, like, will these, how do these end up in on farmer fields in a commercial sense?
Well, so first, before they've come to the chefs, actually, they have been trialed on farms. So we are only bringing things to the chefs that I don't want these chefs to know about things that don't grow well, because they're going to want that. And I don't want them to start demanding things that is, like, you know, and wanting things that we really don't want to do. So it's the things that are out here today and that you're looking at, we know grow well for the farmers. And then, yeah, and then that's when, well, so the Culinary Breeding Network, for instance, has an annual event called the Variety Showcase, and that's where a lot of farmers and chefs, produce buyers and breeders all get together, and they hear from one another, talk to one another, and that's where a lot of change happens, and a lot of farmers start to then see, okay, there's a lot of chefs that are really interested in this variety, I'm going to start growing it. And so we're seeing a lot of varieties being picked up and grown because they see that there's demand for that.
And then where are they getting picked up and grown? They're just wherever, whatever seed distributor is already offering them, or do you have partnerships with specific seed companies or that sort of end?
At that showcase, those seed growers are there. So we have the plant breeders, which oftentimes are at public universities, but they often are with seed companies. So the seed, you know, so the seed company will have a booth, and they'll be showing off what they're working on, or, like, people get to taste what they have. So they are oftentimes, there's two different things that we do, is, like, we have people look at finished available varieties, and that's what can be picked up immediately.
Yeah.
And then they can say, okay, I'm going to start growing this because it's available. And then we also want to have this where we bring people into the conversation really early on in breeding projects. So breeding takes a very long time. And so if Jim Myers from Oregon State University decides, I'm going to work on a pepper, you know, like, he's working on a mild habanero pepper. And if he wants to work on this pepper from the beginning to the end, it's going to take maybe 8 to 10 years.
Yeah.
So we want to bring people in really early on, because those breeders are making a lot of decisions, and they're kind of a lot of times guessing what people want. And so if we have at the beginning F2, F3 generation, where there's a lot of diversity still, and that's diversity in, you know, color, shape, size, all these appearance things, and flavor. We can have people looking at that and tasting that. Then he can use that information in his breeding. Tim is actually
build
doing
a really,
that.
Really strong foundation.
Yeah. And Tim is actually doing that right now with Adaptive Seed, where they have a it's called a land race, and it's a population that's very, very diverse, that someone who's like a homesteader would grow because they want a lot of diversity.
And then they can sort of select the genetics that are interesting to them.
Right. And
on
so
their
that's exactly what we've done. Just literally walking through the fields and, you know, looking at things and touching them and of course tasting them and being like, I like that one and here's why. I like that one, and flagging them. They would then save the seeds, plant another batch, and we're actually talking about going back down there. We talked about it last night. I think, like, next week I'm going to be down there. So,
Tim's been doing a lot of selections for... So this is a kale that has it has Nappus, different species, crossed into it, so it's very, very tender. And so they have all, you know, they have so much diversity in there. They have, you know, purples, and they have greens, and they have very Savoy, and very curly, and
different
frilly,
shapes.
And all these leaf
shapes.
It's a
rainbow of shapes and colors.
It's amazing. And they sell it like that, but then... They're having, it's called Gulag Stars.
Yeah.
Gulag Stars kale. It's a very tender, really nice kale. It came originally from Tim Peters, who's an old breeder.
And an Adaptive Seed. They're an Oregon-based seed company.
They're in Brownsville, Oregon. And so Tim is pulling out of that several different directions for them to create new varieties.
Cool.
Based on, you know, what he sees, which is very different from what they see and what a farmer sees. So that we need a lot of different eyes on this because there's a lot of different desires.
And it's so great when there can be, you know, three or four or five sets of eyes on things at the same time. And there's someone that's a culinary professional. There's, you know, a researcher. There's the people who own the property that are, you know, producing the seeds and you know, breeding for what they see fit. It's just fantastic. I mean, you can learn a lot in a very short amount of time. I could point to one and not look at it quite closely enough and say, Andrew, I like that one. And he's like, really? You're like, you like kale with hairs on it? No.
You're like, I don't want hairy kale. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to, take me on this little culinary breeding tour. And where can people find out more about the work that you guys are doing?
There's a website called culinarybreedingnetwork.com. Also on Instagram, Culinary Breeding Network. Quite active on Instagram.
Great.
It's time for a short break. When we return, we'll hear about the Culinary Breeding Network from a plant breeder's perspective. Stay tuned for Frank Morton of Wild Garden Seeds in Philomath, Oregon, who presented on a panel at the conference titled Community Plant Breeding, Engaging Stakeholders Across the Food System from Eaters to Breeders.
This is Chris Howell from Cane Vineyard and Winery, calling in from Spring Mountain above the Napa Valley. Thank you for listening to this show. In our industrial world of highly processed food and wine, we support the values of Heritage Radio Network. All of us at Cane encourage you to seek out individuality and beauty in everything you eat and drink. To learn more about us, go to cane5.com.
I started out as a salad green grower for restaurants. And as part of that, I developed close relationships with the chefs that generally owned those restaurants that I worked with. So when I was still learning to be a plant breeder, I had the opportunity to always be talking with chefs about how they use the, you know, salad greens and garnishes and the seasonal aspects of the food. And it was always a back and forth between me and the chef, usually through letters that I would write each week with the salad greens I would send to restaurants. So, really, the chefs were consulting with me, to be honest, most of the time. Because my experience has been that most people don't know what is possible in a plant breeding program. And so, at least in the beginning, it was mostly me showing the eaters, the chefs, what was possible seasonally within different species. So that's how I developed most of my varieties to begin with. It was a chef collaboration, but the chefs were not really coming to the farm on a regular basis to look at the breeding material. They would come occasionally, they would see all the possibilities, their eyes would bug out, and they wanted to try everything. Really, they wanted something new. They wanted something new, and once you've worked with chefs for a little while, you begin to know what the markers for quality are, and tenderness, and flavor, and color, and what catches the eye of the person who's going to eat it. So, and novelty, once again, all chefs want novelty. Novelty sells, and chefs are in the business of selling food. So I can only say that really, up until Lane Selman began to take my varieties and take them to chefs and show them the different varieties that I had, up until then, the back and forth between me and the chefs was mostly a one-way thing. Now it's different. And this has really opened up a lot of opportunity for helping sell my varieties, because the Culinary Breeding Network essentially creates exposure that I would never be able to create on my own. And, you know, lucky for me, I know that a chef wants a smooth pepper. They didn't have to tell me that for a roasting pepper, because I have the sort of consciousness from working with them. So, how do we get them involved earlier in the process now? Now that I have this closer two-way thing, it's really nice to have them come to the farm and see all the variety. And it piques their interest. And I can just see by the look on their faces what attracts them, just looking at the beds. And often what attracts the chef attracts me also. So that gives me confidence in my own taste. But there's nothing like having a chef point at something and say, that's what I want, just on the basis of the appearance. And then there is the tasting. But first we eat with our eyes. But the other thing about plant breeding and food availability for chefs or others is, if the plant is not a good crop, it doesn't matter how good it tastes. And this is what I tell chefs over and over. If the variety cannot be economically grown in an appropriate season, in a profitable way, nobody's going to grow it for them. So they will never get to taste the flavor of it. So the plants need to have disease resistance, agronomic qualities that make it a profitable crop. The yield needs to be decent. It needs to have seasonal niches that it fits into, especially niches that are not currently filled. And if all that is true, and it tastes great, that's a good variety. But you can't just start with flavor, which is what a chef would always want to do first. They don't understand the farmer mind, or the farmer situation, enough to actually do some of the more critical aspects of plant breeding. But they know what they like. They know what they like to look at. They know the taste that they like. So it's really a complicated kind of thing. And it is like a conversation. And that's, I would say, it's a conversation. And the earlier you can start the conversation, the better. But it is a conversation.
Well,
That's another episode of the Farm Report. Interested in hearing more? Tune in on heritageradionetwork.org, iTunes, or Stitcher. Thank you so much for listening.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.